this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the first headline across the top of the page. Adherix seeks $45 million to advance GSK drug. Now, this article is written by Frank Van Leeuwen with the dateline of Chapel Hill. Adherix Technologies thinks it can take an anti-cancer compound it licensed from GlaxoSmithKline further than the pharma giant did, and it's now looking to shareholders for up to $45 million to finance development. The Chapel Hill company is offering existing shareholders the opportunity to buy $12 million in shares at a discount. Shareholders participating in the rights offering would receive warrants for future shares that, if exercised, could bring the company an additional $33 million. Proceeds would be used to finance clinical work on enalucerol, a compound whose development GSK terminated after phase 3 clinical trials did not produce positive results. The publicly traded company in Canada, which moved to the Triangle in 2003, is a drug development firm currently without any FDA-approved drugs or revenue. Adherix CEO Rosty Raykov did not return calls seeking comment, but in a filing with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission, the company says it has a hypothesis about why GSK's trials were unsuccessful. In early 2011, Adherix plans to begin enrolling breast cancer patients in a phase 2 trial to see if its hypothesis is right. Enalucerol is being developed to work alongside long-lasting cancer drug fluorouracil, more commonly referred to as 5-FU. 5-FU's history goes back to the 1950s, and it has been a mainstay in treating gastrointestinal cancers and breast cancers, says Dr. Lee Rosen, founder of Premier Oncology in Santa Monica, California. Rosen, who is not affiliated with Adherix, says a number of drug developers have worked with the chemistry of 5-FU to try to enhance its benefits or reduce its side effects. You're trying to improve on the existing stuff. You're not coming up with a completely different mechanism of action, Rosen says. Enalucerol inhibits the enzyme that breaks down 5-FU. It could compete against Roche drug Xelota, which has more than $1 billion in annual sales. Adherix says enalucerol could advance the therapeutic benefit of 5-FU, allow 5-FU to be administered orally instead of intravenously, and reduce occurrence of hand and foot syndrome, a side effect in which the hands and feet swell and become tender. Dr. Marwan Faqih, associate professor and chief of the gastrointestinal section at the Roswell Park Cancer Institute in Buffalo, New York, says different oncology drugs can be combined with 5-FU depending on the kind of cancer that is being treated. But he says drugs have been developed to inhibit the enzyme that enalucerol is targeting. While some have been approved in other countries, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration has been unconvinced that they work better than existing drugs. So far, Faqih is also unconvinced a drug such as enalucerol will result in significant improvement, but he says it's worth seeing what happens in clinical trials. The registration statement for the rights offering does not have an effective date. The offering follows an April private placement with Adherix's largest shareholder, South Point Capital Advisors, in which Adherix raised $7 million for phase 2 work on enalucerol. Kevin Prakey, partner with Williams Mullen in Raleigh, says the rights offering could be a way to bring in other investors who did not participate in the private placement. Adherix's focus on enalucerol follows the decision to abandon ADH-1, a cancer compound licensed from McGill University. Last year, the company shed 13 workers in a cash-saving move and brought on a new management team led by Raykov, an investment and general partner at private investment partnership DCML. The company's chief science officer is Tom Spector, formerly of Glaxo Welcome, and the principal inventor of the enalucerol 5-FU treatment. Adherix, which trades on the Toronto Stock Exchange, has $6.6 million in cash and cash equivalents. And now we move down the page, staying on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal. And the next article, it's in the center of the page, takes up most of the center of the page, has a black border around it. Within that border, the background is blue, but then at the top, there's a drawing of the outside of a hospital. The emergency section has emergency written on the building. The caption reads, "A requested $53.6 million renovation would expand Nash General's emergency department." And then under that, in bold black lettering, is the headline, "Nash joins hospital fray. County facility wants to stop patients going to Triangle." And this article is written by James Gallagher with a dateline of Rocky Mount. Nash General Hospital is looking to spend $53.6 million to expand its emergency department and consolidate and expand its cardiovascular services. The county-owned hospital has filed for state approval through the Certificate of Need system to expand its facilities. The CON system is designed to contain healthcare costs escalation by limiting capital expenditures. Nash hospital leaders say the operation has outgrown its existing facilities and that the nearly 40-year-old building was not constructed in a way to meet modern healthcare needs. As a result, some county residents are traveling to healthcare facilities in Greenville and the Triangle. Hospital spokesman Jeff Hedgepath says the proposed expansion would be the largest since the hospital was built in 1971. Plans call for more than doubling the current emergency department from 21,765 square feet to 51,000 square feet and creating distinct emergency care facilities for adult, pediatric, and psychiatric patients. At the same time, the hospital plans to consolidate cardiovascular services into one area and to add interventional cardiology to the hospital's menu of services. The additional cardiac services, which consist primarily of inserting stents, are intended to capture local patients who have been traveling outside the area for cardiac care, says hospital CEO Larry Chuning. "People are having to leave the community for services," he says, adding that they go in equal numbers to hospitals in Greenville and the Triangle. "We think through some new relationships and expanded services, we can keep more people at home." Several hospitals in recent years, UNC Hospitals and Rex Hospital among them, have taken steps to consolidate their cardiac facilities. UNC recently merged its cardiology, cardiothoracic surgery, vascular surgery, and interventional radiology programs into one heart and vascular center, while Rex has applied for a CON to construct a new cardiac care facility that would consolidate all services into one location. As for Nash General's emergency department, Chuning says the expansion is needed to keep up with growing demand. The hospital, which was built to handle 45,000 emergency patients a year, has seen more than 60,000 patients per year in its emergency department over the past 5 years. Overcrowding has been an issue for Nash's emergency department for some time. In 2003, the healthcare system applied for and received state approval to expand the emergency department. But after the hospital received its CON, executives determined that plan did not fit with growth needs and put off the expansion for 7 years. Nash says in its latest CON application that it plans to use hospital reserves to cover the $53.6 million cost of the proposed expansion. Chuning, though, says debt might be used instead depending on the level of bond rating the hospital can achieve. While the hospital is owned by the county, it does not need county approval to issue debt as long as the repayment schedule does not exceed the length of the hospital's lease arrangement with the county, says Bob Murphy, Nash County manager. Should that happen, says Murphy, the county would renegotiate the lease. Murphy adds that he is glad to see the hospital expanding. "Nash General Hospital is an incredible healthcare asset in our community," he says, adding that the expansion would enhance the hospital's status as an economic engine. And now we move just to the right of that article, still on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal. And this article runs vertically along the right side of the page. The headline, "Heirs Mull Bank Building's Future." And this article is written by Amanda Jones Hoyle with the dateline of Raleigh. And underneath the article, there's a picture, outside picture, looking up at a very large building. The caption reads, "227 Fayetteville Street Building is more than 40 years old." The clock is ticking on a 50-year contract that has bound Wachovia Bank to an 11-story office building in downtown Raleigh that the bank hasn't occupied since 2003. A land lease signed in 1960 between Wachovia and two New York City businessmen is set to expire at midnight on January 31, 2011. In the meantime, the heirs to the estates of those New York businessmen, Morton Rosenfeld and Milton Schwartz, are trying to decide what to do with the 100,000-square-foot property when they take over ownership. The building at 227 Fayetteville Street was Wachovia's local base of operations for more than 40 years. Then came a 2003 merger with rival First Union Bank, and the resulting new Wachovia decided to consolidate operations into the higher-profile Capital Center Tower at 150 Fayetteville Street. After it moved out, the bank found sublease tenants by working out short-term deals primarily with local and state government agencies. All the while, the bank, which soon will take on the Wells Fargo brand, kept its end of the bargain by paying the Rosenfeld and Schwartz families more than $1.6 million over the life of the 50-year contract. The bank opted not to pick up the option to extend the land lease for 25 years. My father couldn't have foreseen what would happen to Wachovia, says New York philanthropist Sue Lehman, daughter of Morton Rosenfeld, who is taking the lead in representing the owners of the Raleigh property. She says they have the options of selling the building and land or negotiating another ground lease with a developer. The quarter-acre property is on the south side of Exchange Plaza. It is bound on the other side by the Market Plaza and the First Citizens Bank building. The building is in about the same condition it was in when Wachovia vacated it 7 years ago, says Ben Kilgore, executive vice president of C.B. Richard Ellis in Raleigh, who was hired by Lehman to help come up with a plan for the downtown property. At some point, it will need a substantial renovation, he says. I'm not sure what they're going to do with the building, but Ms. Lehman is trying to protect their family's investment. The first floor of the building features an escalator to what was the bank branch below. The building has a pedestrian tunnel under South Wilmington Street, connecting it to the Moore Square parking deck. Office occupancy in the downtown Raleigh submarket was 92% in the third quarter of 2010, according to Triangle Business Journal's quarterly space survey. That is much healthier than the Triangle Region occupancy rate of 80%. The biggest challenge we face is not demand, it's inventory, says David Diaz, president and CEO of Downtown Raleigh Alliance. This, the Wachovia building, could be a significant opportunity for any developer or buyer who wants to take over a building on the main street of Raleigh. They're sitting on a really good opportunity. Lehman says she has not put a price on the property, but Wake County real estate records show that the building and land have a combined tax value of $7.2 million. We're going to see what the market brings us, she says. And then we have one last article on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal. And this one runs horizontally across the bottom of the page. The headline, Cuts Could Cast Thousands Out of College Seats. And on the far left side of this article, there's a picture of a man in a coat and tie with a large set of papers, like blueprints, rolled up and under his arm. The caption reads, Wake Tech's Stephen Scott says 10,000 seats may be cut. And this article was written by James Gallagher with a Dateline of Raleigh. State budget cuts are likely to result in thousands of students being turned away from the state's community colleges, dealing yet another blow to the state's already faltering economic recovery. The North Carolina Community College System is budgeting for a 10% or $107 million reduction in state appropriations. The result, system and college officials say, is that students will not be able to get the courses they need when they need them. Stephen Scott, president of Wake Technical Community College, estimates that the college would have to cut about 10,000 classroom seats to meet the cuts. At some point, we will have to say we are full, says Durham Technical Community College President Bill Ingram, adding that he does not want to reduce the quality of education to increase the quantity. The community college system is known for producing a skilled workforce, and the system has long been seen as a major driver of the state's economy. The colleges have been overrun with students in recent years, as many who have lost their jobs train for new skills. Wake Tech's enrollment has grown by more than 10% in each of the last 3 years. And Scott says he expects another year of 10% to 12% student growth next fall. Durham Tech's growth has been a bit more modest, at about 5% in each of the last 3 years. Ingram attributes that to better job stability in the county. Adding to concerns about the funding reduction is the manner in which the system is funded. Unlike the University of North Carolina system, which is funded on the basis of projected enrollment, the community college system is funded on the basis of the previous year's enrollment. That means that when enrollments grow, the colleges already are working with fewer dollars. Jennifer Haygood, the system's vice president and chief financial officer, says system leaders have requested that the state provide an additional $34 million in enrollment growth funding, which should help with some of the new students. Still, those dollars do not make up for the expected appropriation cut. To deal with the cuts, the system has proposed a 17.7% tuition increase, which would raise the per credit hour cost from $56.50 to $66.50. That increase would generate about $46 million in additional revenue. Despite the needed money, some are concerned that the increase would prevent some students from attending the institutions, which have long been known as a low-cost provider of education and workforce training. The system also has proposed altering its funding formula to shift more dollars to more expensive courses, such as labs and healthcare courses, and fewer dollars for less expensive courses, such as basic math or English. Currently, all courses are funded equally. Haygood says system leaders believe such a funding formula better balances the needs of the system to train workers and prepare students for a four-year degree. Ingram applauds the plan, saying it's a good fix to an existing problem. That particular aspect of the system's recommendation for budget reductions really has potential to help us a good bit in the long run as we go forward, he says. And now we turn inside the Triangle Business Journal to the Biz column. The headline that starts it off, LinkedIn placing its bet on apartments for Durham land. Single family is out and apartments are in the world of development, so LinkedIn Corporation is building apartments. The Raleigh company has asked for a rezoning of part of its 96-acre Arrington property on Page Road in Durham near Interstate 40, where it proposes to build 680 apartments along with 1.55 million square feet of office space and 58,000 square feet of retail, according to filings with the Durham City County Planning Department. An out-of-state developer built the 320-unit Colonial Grand at Arrington apartment complex in 2002, but the rest of the Arrington site that was targeted for another 1 million square feet of office and retail space has languished. John McConnell wants to spiff up his Treyburn Country Club golf course in Durham, and he's asking members to chip in to the tune of $1.4 million toward a $2 million renovation. Proposed enhancements to the Tom Fazio design course would encompass renovating the greens, redoing fairway and green bunkers, repairing cart paths, replacing the irrigation pump, and adding a restroom on the back nine, along with contingencies. McConnell Golf, the company the Triangle entrepreneur founded to oversee his courses, including Raleigh Country Club, would spend $600,000 it had earlier committed. McConnell is asking members whose equity stakes McConnell is buying out to approve a $60 monthly dues increase for golf members and $25 for non-golf members for 7 years. An informational meeting was held November 22, and ballots were sent to members afterward. On November 17, 1930, downtown Raleigh welcomed the opening of the Capitol Club building at 16 West Martin Street. And 80 years later, on November 17, 2010, building owner Tom Hendrickson celebrated its anniversary with an open house party in the building's restored Grand Ballroom. Catered by Capitol Club 16's owners, Jake Wolf and Shannon Wolf, who opened their restaurant on the building's ground floor earlier this year, more than 150 people stopped by to see the building, watch the sunset over downtown Raleigh, and join the festivities in the 12th floor ballroom. Among those spotted in the crowd were Mayor Charles Meeker, Golden Corral's James Maynard, former Attorney General Rufus Edmonston, and former NNO publisher Frank Daniels. Deck the streets with boughs of holly. Artsplosure, the Downtown Raleigh Alliance, and other art groups on December 3 will kick off what their leaders hope will be a new Capital City holiday celebration. Among the installments will be a canopy of creative light sculptures in Licton Plaza, fronting the Progress Energy Center for the Performing Arts. Designer-decorated Christmas trees and festive decorations will adorn the three lobbies of the building. Also, a series of outdoor and indoor events are planned by Broadway Series South, North Carolina Theater, North Carolina Symphony, and other groups throughout December. For more information and a schedule of events, visit www.progressenergycenter.com. Fa-la-la-la-la, la-la-la-la. Quite a collection of culinary talent will gather at the Umstead Hotel and Spa on December 2 for the 8th annual Gingerbread Benefit. Chefs from some of the area's fine dining restaurants, including Second Empire Restaurant and Tavern, Farrington House Restaurant, and the Umstead's own Herons, will build lavish gingerbread houses to auction off as part of the festivities. The event raises money for Raleigh-based Triangle Family Services, which helps people work through crisis in their lives. Intellectual property law firm, the Eclipse Group LLP, has beefed up its local roster by adding Nathan Letts in its Durham office. Letts previously served as in-house counsel and vice president of intellectual property and licensing at Diadexis Incorporated, a biotechnology firm based in San Francisco. The Eclipse Group has about 40 lawyers in 5 offices, including 3 in California. With the addition of Letts, it now has 4 attorneys in Durham. Thinking of following up your Black Friday shopping with a few Cyber Monday purchases at work? Think again. IT staffing firm Robert Half Technology says 48% of chief information officers interviewed recently said they block online shopping sites from company networks. Another 34% allowed access to shopping sites but monitored for excessive use. Just 14% allowed unrestricted access, while 4% responded they don't know. CIOs who say they allow access to shopping sites expect employees to spend 3 hours per week on average shopping online. 3 hours? Jeez. Biz thought shopping online was supposed to save time. Floor tape manufacturer Insight Solutions recently got its 15 minutes of fame on television. The Wake Forest company donated 1,000 feet of its floor marking tape to Lanier Elementary School in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. NBC reality show School Pride featured the renovation of the 52-year-old school on its October 22 episode. While Insight tape is used for marking floors in industrial settings, company owner Cliff Lowe says he always thought it could find a place in schools. It's designed to handle forklifts dragging heavy pallets over it, he says. The kids won't damage it. Triad-based Banyan Research, an executive recruiting agency, has opened up shop in Raleigh. Mac Lewis serves as managing partner of the firm's Capital City office and will focus on the recruitment of finance and accounting professionals in the Triangle. Some feel-good things are happening in the Bull City. Representatives of 6 local nonprofit organizations met in Durham on November 17 in partnership with Durham Cares and Google Voice to provide area homeless people and others in need with a permanent phone number and voicemail. The idea is that once a needy person is able to obtain a stable phone number and voicemail capability, it becomes easier for them to find gainful employment and later find a permanent residence. At the event, Google Voice, a telecommunications service provided by Google, doled out 500 voice cards to those in need. This is only the 2nd installment of such a program for Google Voice. The first of the recipients were in San Francisco. We hope this card donation will help our homeless search for jobs, maintain family connections, and take care of other personal matters, such as securing living arrangements, says Harry Kastner, co-founder of Durham Cares and co-founder and executive chairman of Bandwidth.com, he said in a statement. The participating charities are Genesis Home, TROSA, Housing for New Hope, Durham Rescue Mission, Dress for Success, and Sales and Service Training Center. Each received approximately 83 cards to give out. Coming to Durham on December 4 is the Rock and Shop Market, which organizers describe as a hip flea market. Michelle Smith and Reagan Wood have decided they want the market, which debuted in Raleigh in 2004, to have a permanent home in Durham. After all, everyone knows Durham is more hip than Raleigh. The market, to be held at the new Motorco Music Hall, will feature fashion, art, and music from emerging designers and bands. Only Burger, Clousey's Pizza, and Daisy Cakes food trucks will set up in the parking lot. Be warned, there is an admission charge of $5. Tired of waiting in traffic to get to the RBC Center Arena for a Carolina Hurricanes hockey game or concert and still have to pay $10 to park? Raleigh-based Pepsi Bottling Ventures is now offering free rides on a first-come, first-served basis to the arena via its Pepsi Caniac Coach chartered bus. No purchase is necessary. The big luxury bus picks up passengers in front of participating restaurants starting 55 minutes prior to game time. The bus has more than 20 stops along a route that begins at the Midtown Grill at North Hills and travels through the Glenwood South District and downtown Raleigh before heading to the arena. The bus returns passengers to their pickup points with a departure time 20 minutes after an event is over. Pepsi went live with its website, www.caniaccoach.com. on November 15 with details about the bus route, pickup times, a list of participating restaurants, and an RBC Center event schedule, says Pepsi's Lyndon Knowles. Other sponsors of the bus are Eye Care Associates, Rex UNC Healthcare, Sunkist, and Coach America. All you Wolfpack and Blue Devil fans may want to skip the next item. Veteran Charlotte Observer sports columnist Scott Fowler has come out with a book that's guaranteed to be on every UNC Chapel Hill fan's Christmas wish list. It's called What It Means to Be a Tar Heel, Roy Williams and North Carolina's Greatest Players. The Ode to Carolina Blue Basketball features the insights of more than 40 UNC athletes and coaches, including everyone from Larry Brown and George Karl to Phil Ford, James Worthy, and Tyler Hansbrough. Wonder how he missed Ramsey's. The Hibernian Pub on Glenwood South in Raleigh is the best Irish bar in North Carolina. At least that's the conclusion drawn from a nationwide competition engineered by IrishBeerFinder.com and Strangford Low Brewing Company. A whopping 11,000 bar reviews from patrons were received in the search to find the best Irish bar in the USA, with competition running from October 4 through October 31. As for the best Irish bar in America, it goes to Crow Patrick's Pub in Willoughby, Ohio. Close behind in second place was O'Neill's Pub in Philadelphia, and in third place was Bub's Irish Pub in Germantown, Wisconsin. A state-by-state rundown of the winners can be found at IrishBeerFinder.com. Contributing to Biz were staffers Cameron Snipes, Frank Van Leeuwen, James Gallagher, Amanda Jones-Hoyle, and Chris Basden. And now we return to our full-length stories in the Triangle Business Journal. The first one we come to on page 3 runs across the top of the page, the headline, Bonds on Future Taxes Pondered. Now, this article runs vertically across the top of the page, but at the far right side of the article, there's a picture of a woman in business attire. The caption reads, Janet Cowell heads up North Carolina's treasurer's office. And this article is written by Lee Weisbecker with the Dateline of Raleigh. It would be like a payday loan on steroids. State officials looking at various ways of coping in the coming months with should cash become even tighter, have started looking at their options, and one idea coming under scrutiny would have governments, both state and local, issuing bonds on taxes they expect to collect down the road. Tax anticipation notes, TANs, they're called, The General Assembly's Revenue Laws Committee, the body that studies major tax issues and related money matters for the legislature, recently asked the Treasurer's Office whether the practice would even be legal in the state. The answer was yes. In fact, reported Deputy Treasurer Vance Holloman, one local government in North Carolina actually did it once more than two decades ago. It's just a cash tool, says Tony Blaylock, director of the Carolinas Municipal Advisory Council, the group that rates the bond issuances of smaller municipalities. And I really can't recall the last time anybody used it, he says. Even so, the TAN idea may or may not catch on as officials look for ways to make ends meet in a time of significant budget shortfalls. Right now, there doesn't seem to be a wholesale rush toward the practice. This was an alternative discussed by the General Assembly, says Chris Mackey in Governor Beverly Perdue's office. There will be no push from the state to do this. It would be frowned upon by bond rating companies, and we have never done this before. We haven't heard it discussed, says Todd McGee of North Carolina Association of County Commissioners. But if severe budget problems continue, I wouldn't be surprised to hear people talking about alternatives. The government issuing the TANs would sell the notes to investors who would receive moderate interest payments. According to Holloman, any bonds or notes issued by a government could not exceed 50% of uncollected taxes and would have to be backed by the full taxing power of the issuing jurisdiction. Towns and counties would be borrowing against expected sales and property tax collections, the state against yet-to-be-collected sales, payroll, and corporate taxes. Also, on the state level, the governor and council of state would have to sign off on any borrowings before the bond issues could see the light of day. Blaylock, for one, doesn't like the idea. TANs, he says, send the wrong signal. It is seen as a sign of weakness in your budgetary practices and your reserves, he says, adding that TANs can be a red flag for bond rating agencies. With the state looking at a $3 billion shortfall in the worst recession in 75 years, I can see why this would come up, says Blaylock. But we really hope they don't become necessary. Local governments, he adds, collect most of their property taxes in November and December and often have to exist on sales tax revenue before then. A TAN could help them raise cash during the months from July through October, Blaylock says. But again, from a rating agency standpoint, we really hope they don't become necessary. And now we go down to the middle of page 3, where there's an article with a black border around it. Inside that border, first at the top, there's a picture of a woman going through a scanner at the airport. The caption reads, "Travelers deal with TSA scanners across America." And then under that, in bold black lettering, is the headline, "RDU, no to TSA shift. Florida congressman wants private companies to take over TSA's work at nation's airports." And this article is written by Chris Basden, with a dateline of Morrisville. Plenty of people are upset with the Transportation Security Administration these days, but don't count the Raleigh-Durham International Airport Authority among the beleaguered federal agency's detractors. RDU officials say they plan to stick with TSA-provided security personnel, despite a request from an influential congressman who wants the country's top airports to replace government-employed security personnel with private sector contracted workers. Even if private contractors were used, they would still have to operate by TSA's rules and regulations. The request comes at a time when TSA is under fire for its new screening procedures, including utilizing full-body scanners and invasive pat-downs. RDU received the appeal this month in a letter from Representative John Mica, a Floridian, who serves as the ranking Republican on the U.S. House of Representatives Committee on Transportation and Infrastructure. The letter doesn't address the controversy over the pat-downs and full-body scanners. Instead, Mica argues that TSA has become a huge, unwieldy bureaucracy and that it is, quote, both inappropriate and inefficient for the TSA to serve as the administrator, quality assurance regulator, operator, and auditor of its own activities, unquote. Justin Hacklerode, a spokesman for the Transportation and Infrastructure Committee, says Mica doesn't think TSA should try to do it all. The regulator should never regulate itself, he says, adding that MiCA thinks the private sector offers more in terms of innovation, cost efficiency, and customer service. The Associated Press recently reported that MiCA received about $81,000 in campaign contributions over 13 years from donors associated with companies that provide private screening services at airports. Hackleroad says those contributions have no influence on MiCA's push for airports to convert to the private screening model. TSA has 426 employees at RDU. The Airport Authority will not participate in the opt-out program, RDU spokeswoman Mindy Hamlin wrote in an email. RDU has a good relationship with the TSA, and they have done a very good job implementing the federal security measures here at RDU. As a result, we see no reason to make a change. Cost wouldn't be a concern for the airport, at least not as the opt-out program is currently structured. That's because the federal government, which now directly pays TSA workers, would reimburse the airport for contractors. Hamlin writes that RDU has no estimates on the cost since it has not pursued the opt-out program. There would be other concerns for the airport, including liability. MiCA says in his letter that the airport's legal exposure is well protected in law, but Jim Tatum, a Moore and Van Allen attorney who represents RDU, says that while there is an effort to provide protection, there's a real question about how effective that is. Nationally, only 17 airports currently utilize private screeners, according to MiCA's letter, while several more are examining the possibility. One airport that recently made the decision to go to private contractors is Orlando-Sanford International Airport. Larry Dale, president and CEO of Orlando-Sanford, thinks the free enterprise system will provide plenty of motivation for private screeners. Those people have to earn it every day to keep it, he says. Maybe so, but it's clear that many of the security tactics that currently are antagonizing passengers would not change just because an airport switched from TSA screeners to private ones. All commercial airports are regulated by TSA, whether the actual screening is performed by TSA officers or private companies, writes John Allen, a TSA spokesman, in an email. TSA sets the security standards that must be followed, including the use of enhanced pat-downs and imaging technology if installed at the airport. Capital leaders can wiggle out and get payoff. That's the headline on our next article. This one's written by Lee Weisbecker with a Dateline of Raleigh. And under the article, there's a picture of a man in coat and tie standing in a hallway in front of a picture. The caption reads, Capital's Grant Yarber stands to get $3.35 million. The federal TARP program, which lent Capital Bank $41 million in 2008, flatly bans golden parachute payments to bank managers. But that won't stop four key capital executives from rolling in a combined $5.7 million in change of control payouts if regulators approve the bank's absorption into Charlotte-based North American Financial Holdings. The players in the deal will sidestep the regulation by cashing Capital Bank out of the Troubled Asset Relief Program, perhaps at a steep discount, before the merger takes place. With that maneuver, the change of control payouts, including $3.35 million to CEO Grant Yarber, would come after Capital Bank is officially out of the program. By paying it off first, you no longer come under the TARP restrictions, says Raleigh bank attorney Tony Gaeta, who has studied the issue for his clients. Such cash outs have quickly become both a closing condition and the standard operating procedure in many recent bank acquisitions, says U.S. Treasury Department spokesman Mike Postenbach. Change of control payments are a relatively common practice in bank boardrooms. They are a recognition that the job the executive is taking might go away, says bank analyst Don Coker. Along with executive salaries, they have become lightning rods for criticism since TARP began pumping billions of taxpayer dollars into the banking system in late 2008. And that's only understandable, says Coker. In addition to Yarber, other capital executives in line for a change of control payday are CFO Michael Moore, $1 million, Chief Credit Officer Mark Redman, $602,347, and Chief Banking Officer David Morgan, $706,867. The figures were included in a Capitol Bank filing with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. Asked to comment, Yarber said the change of control money coming his way is part of his retirement package. And I would be receiving it now because the retirement plan, originally drafted by capital managers, will cease to exist, he said, adding that he doesn't believe the funds would have come under the TARP ban in the first place. NAFH has agreed to buy 71 million shares, or 85%, of capital stock at $2.55 a share. The proposed merger, which must win the approval of the Office of the North Carolina Commissioner of Banks and the Federal Reserve, is expected to wrap up in the first quarter of 2011. The matter also must go before Capital Bank shareholders at a special meeting scheduled for December 16. On the heels of the financial crisis of 2008, Capital decided to take part in the Troubled Asset Relief Program, trading preferred shares and warrants for common stock in the bank for $41.27 million. That was in December 2008. Capital since has paid $3.45 million in interest on the money, with its latest dividend payment being on November 15. In another recent SEC filing, Capital says it is still negotiating its TARP exit. If the talks proceed as they have gone for other community banks, the preferred shares would be converted to common shares at a much reduced liquidation price, perhaps as much as a 50% discount. And our last article on page 3 in the Triangle Business Journal, it runs along vertically along the bottom of the page. It has a greenish olive background, and has two face pictures of the current publisher of the Triangle Business Journal and the new publisher. The headline, TBJ's Hamilton named paper's publisher, marketing director to succeed Charlene Grunwald, who has helmed Business Journal since 1991. And this article was written by Jeff Drew with the Dateline of Raleigh. American City Business Journals on Tuesday named Brian Hamilton to the new publisher of Triangle Business Journal. Hamilton, who has served as TBJ's Director of Marketing and Circulation for the past 3 years, succeeds Charlene Grunwald, who has served as TBJ's publisher since American City Business Journals bought the newspaper in 1991. Grunwald announced retirement plans last month. She will work with Hamilton through a transition process over the next few weeks. I am honored and excited to be given the opportunity to build upon the success that TBJ has experienced the last 19 years under Char Grunwald's leadership, Hamilton says. Triangle Business Journal has a phenomenal team. I look forward to what we'll be able to accomplish together. Since joining TBJ in November 2007, Hamilton has led the newspaper to double-digit growth in circulation, while also growing the TBJ brand through initiatives such as the BizMix networking event series and Smart Reader seminars. Hamilton's career with Charlotte-based ACBJ stretches back to 2004, when he was hired as an advertising account executive with the Orlando Business Journal. He consistently beat sales goals during his 3 years there. Prior to his stint at Orlando Business Journal, Hamilton worked 5 years in a variety of roles, including retail sales manager and territory operations leader at Gateway Companies Incorporated. Hamilton, a native of Syracuse, New York, holds a Bachelor of Arts in Advertising and Public Relations from the University of Central Florida. The 33-year-old lives in Garner with his wife, Teresa, and their 5 daughters. Highway funding prospects murky in wake of elections. That's the title of our next article, written by Chris Basden with the Dateline of Washington, D.C. And along with the article, there's a picture of a group of workers, roadside workers, with their orange jackets on. The caption reads, "Congress has to approve new highway bill." The recent congressional elections have clouded the prospects for a new federal highway bill, the law that allocates the billions of dollars sent to the states by the feds for road work, at a time when the construction business is desperate for work. And industry insiders are concerned that the mood in the nation's capital may not bode well for them. Republican candidates steamrolled many Democratic opponents this year by campaigning against government spending on the stimulus, industry bailouts, and a new health care program. Now in control of the U.S. House of Representatives, fiscal hawks are in a strong position to block President Barack Obama's policy proposals and implement their own. In an environment as partisan as Washington, D.C., that could set the stage for a governmental deadlock on a number of issues, including the long-stalled highway bill reauthorization. The worry is that it's just going to be a status quo lame duck situation, says Drew Johnson, a vice president at Tarboro-based Barnhill Contracting Company. It is a threat that we could be sitting in the same situation for the next 2 years. The last highway legislation included a five-year, $286 billion allocation with the clunky formal name of the Transportation Equity Act, a legacy for users. TEALU expired in September 2009, and the country has been operating on a series of temporary extensions since then. The problem with temporary extensions is that they limit the amount of long-term planning that state departments of transportation can undertake. That planning problem then trickles down to road building contractors who have to make tough decisions regarding equipment purchases and headcount levels. So why has it been so tough getting a bill done? The big issue has been finding the funding to do a robust bill, says Jack Basso, the director of program finance and management at the American Association of State Highway and Transportation Officials. About 86% of the revenue used to fund the current transportation legislation comes from the 18.4-cent tax, federal tax, on a gallon of gasoline at retail. That tax level hasn't changed since 1993, despite increases in fuel efficiency. But the bigger problem is that the number of vehicle miles traveled declined a couple of years ago due to the recession and higher gas prices. Big truck sales also dropped around the same time. A tax on tractor-trailer rig sales accounts for about 10% of the transportation funding revenue. A new bill would be a badly needed salve for a construction industry that's been hammered by the recession. Advocates argue that there's a lot at stake, saying new legislation would help reduce the unemployment rate in addition to improving the country's aging infrastructure. It's important for the country, says Ward Nye, the president and CEO of Raleigh-based aggregates producer Martin Marietta Materials. It's important for our company. It's important for job creation. And our next article, Inside the Triangle Business Journal, is written by Frank Van Leeuwen with a Dateline of Raleigh. The headline, Regulators Step Up Review as Progress's South Carolina Plant Withers. And along with this article, there's a picture, a far-off picture across some water of a nuclear plant. The caption reads, The Robinson Nuclear Plant came online in 1971. Federal regulators are stepping up their oversight of a Progress Energy nuclear plant in South Carolina that has experienced two extended unplanned outages this year, including one sparked by fire. Progress's Robinson Nuclear Plant in Hartsville, South Carolina, will now be subject to more inspections by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, which Progress will have to pay for. The NRC outlined its conclusions in a November 12 letter to Progress Vice President Robert Duncan. Progress has 30 days to respond to the NRC's report. The greater scrutiny comes as Progress's expenses on its nuclear operations climb. In the first 9 months of 2010, Progress's nuclear operations and maintenance expenses totaled $841 million, up by $74 million compared to the same period in 2009. In a conference call to discuss third quarter financial results, Progress CFO Mark Mulhern told analysts that the nuclear operations and maintenance spending increase was due primarily to unplanned outages at the Robinson plant. Hughes adds Progress will not be looking for regulatory approval of a rate rider to pass its Robinson repair costs on to the ratepayers. He says the cost of replacement power will be covered in the company's annual filing to recover costs of fuel and purchase power. Duncan was unavailable for comment. Progress spokesman Mike Hughes says the outages did not endanger anyone at the plant or the public. He adds that the utility will continue to work with the NRC until the Robinson plant's performance returns to levels the company and the NRC expects. The first outage in March was caused by a fire in electrical equipment. The plant remained shut down until July. A second unplanned outage occurred in October due to a separate electrical problem in a reactor coolant pump. The plant is expected to come back online later this month. NRC spokesman Roger Hanna says progress has taken steps to address concerns raised by the outages, including reviewing training and plant procedures, but the NRC hasn't requested specific actions of progress. Our goal is to make sure they do the right things and operate the plant safely, Hanna says. Unless there's a clear safety issue, we don't tell them what to do. But the NRC has raised its scrutiny of Robinson by moving it one level higher in its five-step scale of oversight, from licensee response to regulatory response. That's a move from level 1 to level 2. The highest step would mean shutting down the plant. Under regulatory response, Robinson is subject to more NRC inspections, and the plant will remain at that level for at least a year. Robinson is the only plant in Progress's fleet in regulatory response. When a plant goes offline unexpectedly, a utility has to find ways to replace the power, which can be costly. Jim Warren, executive director of utilities watchdog group NC Warren, says it's hard to determine how costly the first outage was to Progress, but he says unplanned outages do cost utilities in terms of the increased inspection and reporting to the NRC. And the last full-length article we'll have time for is written by Frank Van Leeuwen with the Dayline of Raleigh. The headline, BDSI suffers Canada launch delay due to contractor woes. Company CEO expects no additional inspection from the FDA because shutdown was voluntary. BioDelivery Sciences International's Canada launch of its lead drug is being delayed until late winter due to regulatory problems faced by the Raleigh company's contract manufacturer. Aviva Drug Delivery Systems, in August, voluntarily shut down manufacturing at its Maitland, Florida plant, where BDSI's product, Onsolis, is produced. The move was made to address concerns raised by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration in a May warning letter. BDSI announced on November 23 that manufacturing has resumed. Onsolis was originally scheduled to launch in Canada last quarter. CEO Mark Sergo now says Onsolis should be available in Canada no later than March. Sergo addressed the matter at a conference call with analysts to discuss third quarter financial results. Sergo says the problems at Aviva's plant were not related to Onsolis. Although the Canada launch of Onsolis will be delayed, U.S. supplies are unaffected because there is sufficient inventory available. Sergo says the delay will not be material to BDSI's operations, and with the improvements Aviva is making to its facility, future Onsolis manufacturing will be more secure. In our view, this outweighs any delay in the Canadian launch, Sergo says. In the past 3 weeks, BDSI shares have taken a beating, however. After spiking up to $3.60 a share earlier this month, the stock currently trades at about $2.80 a share, a 20% drop in less than a month. Onsolis is used for breakthrough cancer pain. The product is a drug delivery system consisting of a small dissolvable film applied to the inside of the cheek that delivers the powerful pain-killing drug fentanyl. The May 21 warning letter to Aviva stems from violations observed during FDA inspections last year. FDA Florida District Director Emma Singleton says in a letter that the violations were related to types of patches made by Aviva and include observations that the company lacked procedures for quality assurance and did not investigate complaints of patches that did not adhere properly. Besides Onsolis, Aviva makes skin patches used to deliver drugs for smoking cessation, asthma, pain management, and other indications. Sergo says Aviva voluntarily shut down all manufacturing operations in order to focus on addressing the FDA concerns. Steps taken include the addition of staff and a reorganization of the quality control area associated with most of the FDA's concerns. Sergo says that because the Aviva plant shutdown was voluntary, no FDA reinspection was necessary before the restart. BDSI reported $217,203 in third quarter revenue, $2.6 million in revenue for the 9 months ending September 30. The company is not yet profitable, reporting a $5.5 million loss through the first 9 months of 2010. Sergo says BDSI still needs to assess with Aviva the expense of the manufacturing delay. And we'll stop there with this article as it goes on to discuss the history of the drug on Solis and when it was approved for different parts of the world. And with a few minutes remaining, we'll turn to the TriangleBusinessJournal.com. Here are some of the news you may have missed on TBJ's website. Bull City grows past Winston-Salem. Durham has long been able to claim a place among the five largest cities in North Carolina. Now, the Bull City can take its place among the top four. Durham has passed Winston-Salem in population, according to the latest estimates by Buffalo Business First, a sister paper of Triangle Business Journal. The city of Durham had 237,214 residents as of November 22, while Winston-Salem boasts an estimated population of 234,268. A year ago, Winston-Salem had 229,828 residents compared to 229,171 in Durham. Raleigh remains firmly entrenched as the second biggest city in North Carolina, with a population of 426,708. Raleigh ranks comfortably ahead of Greensboro, 260,927, but well behind Charlotte, 729,781. Lennar set to start work on a new 307-home development. National home builder Lennar Corporation is getting ready to put a lot of contractors back to work after having closed on the purchase of 40 acres of land for a new community within the Way Development Project near the RBC Center Arena. Lennar closed on a deal with Post Properties of Atlanta on November 22 to pay $5.3 million for land already approved for 307 single-family and townhouse lots. That equals out to a payment of $17,264 per lot. Lennar's land grading equipment is already being moved to the property to begin work at the site. Charges filed in investment scam case. State securities regulators have arrested a 60-year-old Durham man on charges of running an investment scam that allegedly bilked 16 investors, many of them retired teachers, out of $1 million. Walter Ray Reinhart made a first appearance in Durham County Court on 38 felony counts of securities fraud, 12 felony counts of common law forgery, and 12 felony counts of common law uttering. He's currently in the Durham County Jail under a $10 million bond. From November 2005 until May 2009, according to a release from the North Carolina Secretary of State's office, Reinhart allegedly solicited North Carolina investors for a variety of companies owned by a Richmond, Virginia businessman, promising the investors interest returns in the 8% to 10% range. In some cases, Reinhart allegedly cut and taped residents' signatures without their authorization to agreements in order to invest their money, the release says. Cary again ranks among safest cities. Cary has taken top honors as the safest city in North Carolina and in the Southeast, an honor that the town has held for 12 years running. A new CQ Press crime report, which ranked 400 cities of 75,000 people or more across the U.S., pegs Cary as the eighth safest city in America, on the 393rd least safe, Cary fared well because of its low rates for murder, rape, robbery, aggravated assault, burglary, and car theft. Raleigh scored slightly better than the national average for major crimes and ranked as 164th safest city in the country. Durham didn't fare quite as well, finishing as the 117th most dangerous city in the country, just ahead of Charlotte at number 118. And we've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. So long until next time.